Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to Cover Story by New Books Network, a podcast where we talk about people who write, edit, and publish long-form journalism. My name is Aga Popenda, and I'm your host, and today we're talking with British writer Ian Leslie, an author of long-form journalism, and three books on very controversial subjects. Born Liars, about the power of lying, Curious about human curiosity, and most recently, very fresh, Conflicted, about the usefulness of conflict, I guess. Ian regularly appears in The Guardian, The New Statesman, The Economist. How else would you describe yourself? What am I missing?
I think that's a fair summary. Yeah, I write books about human behavior. I suppose I take an aspect of human behavior that I think is that we're looking at the wrong way. And I try and make people see it afresh. And I do that by talking to experts from various different disciplines and kind of bring together insight from lots of different places. A book about lying, as you say, a book about curiosity. And this one is about how to disagree better. I just think we're not very good at disagreement and conflict and we need to get better at it. So this is my little contribution to that effort.
Right. And we will talk about it in depth. I just also would like to point out that you also co-hosted a podcast titled Polarized. So you're not new to podcasting. And I was wondering about this formula of a podcast. I was wondering if a podcast is a good platform to practice conflict in a safe environment, because, you know, there's always this exchange. What do you think?
Yes. I mean, I do think it's a better place to have argument and disagreement than Twitter or Facebook, you know, because you're not just consuming the other person's words, you're actually hearing their voice, and you can get a lot of information from the way that somebody says something that you can't get, or it's a lot more difficult to get when you're just reading letters in a text box. So I think it's interesting. I do think podcasts is a space where people can discuss these contentious issues without getting into stupid fights, hopefully.
Yeah. So the piece we are talking about is How to Have Better Arguments Online, that's just appeared in The Guardian. What is the relation of this piece to the whole book? Can we think about it as a first chapter, a summary, some post-book thoughts?
It's a good kind of flavor of the book as a whole, I would say, and it's really a summary of the opening argument that I make in the book, which is why we need to talk about disagreement at all. Like, why am I arguing that we are so bad at it? Why do we need to improve at it? Why hasn't the internet made us, you know, more harmonious and more peaceable? And then I get into some of the advice in the book that I get from experts, like people who work in interrogation or hostage negotiation, people who have very tough conflict-ridden conversations. They have great insight to offer into how to handle these difficult disagreements. So I get into some of that as well. So it's a pretty good cross-section of the book. The only thing about it is that the headline is How to Have Better Arguments Online, I think, or something like that. It's only partly about online. And in fact, the book as a whole, I don't spend that much time talking about online in environments. It's about all kinds of disagreement and face-to-face as much as anything else.
So do you remember when you knew, the moment when you realized that you will write a book about conflict and why?
I don't think there was a particular eureka moment, but I started thinking about it just because perhaps I was spending too much time on Twitter, actually. But I was just seeing a lot of really terrible arguments, a lot of animosity and anger and outrage, and people who kind of people pretending to disagree and argue, but actually not really, just abusing each other. And you see that not just on social media, but you see it in the political realm, you know, as well. And so my first thought was, okay, how can we argue and so on without falling out, right? Maybe that's what I want to write about, because I do think it's incredibly important. But as I looked into it, and the more I thought about it, the more I thought, actually, the problem is almost the opposite. Most people are not getting into toxic arguments all the time. It seems like that if you spend a lot of time on social media, but most people in your daily life are not. And in fact, the biggest problem is that we avoid open disagreement and open conflict, and that we are, as societies, I think we're already fairly uncomfortable with it, and we're getting increasingly uncomfortable with it. And we need to address that, because there are huge benefits of good, open, constructive disagreement. And when you kind of turn away from it because it's uncomfortable or stressful, I think there's a huge downside to that. So the book is really saying, you know, we need to have more arguments, more disagreements, more open conflict, but we need to do it intelligently and constructively. So here's how.
But at the same time, if I understand it correctly, you advocate on the behalf of being moderate, correct? That's something that I saw on your Twitter.
Oh, right. Yeah, I have a joke.
Recently. Yeah. I was just wondering if what's the relation of seeking moderation would be more like seeking compromise, or maybe are we talking here, for example, in our politics about, steady, small conflict, kind of small explosions, but no revolution. You know what I mean? I just wonder what's the balance between conflict, for example, in politics and moderating yourself and not going to extremes?
Yeah, I this is a really good question and a sort of deep question. I'm not arguing that everybody should be moderate and nice to each other all the time, that we should be super kind of coolly rational all the time. I think we should argue with our heart as well as our head, right? We should argue passionately. And we should kind of throw ourselves into debate and disagreement. And sometimes we should be immoderate, right? We shouldn't always be moderate. But I guess what I'm saying is, unless you have some kind of control over that, and you unless you give some thought to what you're doing to the other person in this debate or disagreement, you just end up with no disagreement because the other person leaves the room. Mm-hmm. You know, metaphorically or literally, you want to have a passionate disagreement, but you also want to keep the other person engaged, you know, in the conversation. Otherwise, you're just not having the disagreement. Now, that's not always possible. Sometimes you're arguing with people who are just not worth your time, right? And it might take you a while to figure that out. But on the whole, the book is making a case for saying actually, you know, you could have much more productive, much more interesting disagreements with people, with your opponents, whether they're your opponents politically or just, you know, on a particular issue, say at work, if you follow some of these basic guidelines. And yeah, I don't think it all has to be moderate or rational. I actually, you know, we think a lot better when we are emotional. You know, it's not like there's we're either emotional or we're intelligent. Like the more kind of emotional, more your heart is in something, the more you apply your intelligence to it. So I think that is a bit of a false dichotomy.
Okay. And you're bringing in the article an example of AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, our young American politician here, who's... I was wondering, you describe her little tactic that she uses with her interlocutors is pretty much about using empathy. And I was wondering, is she good in conflict? And also, because, you know, she's not a moderate person, and also many people, don't get me wrong, I absolutely adore her, but many people see her as a very conflicting person, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I quote from her. There's a great talk she gives, and there's a great passage in it where she talks about what she learned from community organizing, how to kind of bring people around to your side. One of the things she says is you give people the golden gate of retreat, I think she calls it. What she means is allow the other person, you know, if you're in an argument, show them a way out that enables them to look good, right? Your job is not to kind of crush them and show them how wrong they are, to humiliate them, which frankly is how a lot of these arguments play out, right? Your job is to help them find a way to agree with you that doesn't humiliate them, that actually makes them feel pretty good about themselves, right? That's quite a skillful kind of art. And I thought it was a really good point. As to her as a politician, I don't know. That's a separate kind of question. Mm-hmm. My concern about her, or like just, you know, not her kind of brand of politics, is that it actually involves a lot of talking to their own side. What I worry about is that they have slightly given up on trying to engage with people with whom they disagree. I think that, you know, maybe she could take a little bit of her own advice, but it certainly was good advice.
Yeah. So the most interesting and happy thought in the article was the one that that conflict in internet on social media doesn't necessarily divides us, and it's actually bursting bubbles, and that's kind of something it's a happy thought. Can you tell us more about it, because that's not necessarily something that is obvious, right? We feel more and more divided, but you say that explorations online will eventually bring us together, and that internet users encounter more conflict and more different opinions.
Yes, I mean, I'm not that bullish about, not that optimistic about social media, but in this context, anyway. I do think that sometimes the way we talk about it is slightly the wrong way round. We talk about the filter bubble, and, you know, it's this idea that we only ever hear from people that we already agree with, that already think like us, and that can be a problem. But actually, the reason there's so much kind of toxicity and acrimony out there on social media is that actually we're confronted with way more disagreeable opinions than ever before in history. You know, I grew up in a filter bubble. In my house, we watched the BBC news, and my parents bought the same newspaper every day. and that was it, you know. Now that is a filter bubble. These days you get on the internet and you know, within 30 seconds you see 100 things that you disagree with, and a lot of those opinions and information are framed as, you know, they're outrageous, they're sort of emotionally charged, they're very kind of like angry or upsetting. You don't come across angering, upsetting things on a daily basis. And someone did a study of this and, you know, found this to be empirically true, that, you know, on a day-to-day basis, we don't very often come across things that make us go, oh, that's horrible, that's outrageous, that's really kind of got me angry. Whereas online, it happens a lot. So there's this kind of parade of injustices and atrocities. And that kind of, you know, inevitably leads to this sort of slightly futile war of outrage, where everybody's getting, you know, annoyed with each other all the time. So it's just an example of, because I don't think it's just about social media, as I say, but it's an example of how the modern world presents us with a lot more disagreeable opinions than we've been used to historically. But we haven't been trained or prepared for how to deal with confronting disagreeable opinions. And you know, I think we're just not really remotely prepared for what's happening.
Okay, so if we were writing a history of conflict, are we better or worse as humanity in conflict, or is it too early to tell?
Well, in the type of conflict I'm talking about, which is, you know, argument rather than military conflict or fighting, which is kind of mm-hmm. what happens when arguments just stop, you know, when we yeah. give up. I would say that we are, it's a relatively new development that we do it so much. It's for most of our existence as a species, as civilizations, we've lived effectively, you know, we've lived in filter bubbles, you know, we've lived in pretty settled tribes and then and communities, where even when there were things that you were disagreeing about, you know, in terms of how you run the city, there is a huge host of things on which you all agree. You agree on which god or gods you're worshipping, you know. You agree on the hierarchy, the basic hierarchy of the society that you're in. And obviously I'm talking in huge kind of historical broad sweeps here, but what you're seeing is a collapse of those things, particularly, you know, over the last sort of 200-300 years, and then it's kind of accelerated in the last century, and then accelerated again as with the rise of the internet. You're seeing a much greater diversity of opinions in every situation. You're seeing a far greater diversity of values and religious and political backgrounds and ethoses involved in every conversation. Everybody has the right to speak, right? We you know, in theory anyway, we live in a much more democratic, egalitarian society than we ever have. And so everybody's kind of talking back to each other all the time. Now, that's good, right? Because I love that. Most of us love that. We love the fact that this is a society where people don't know their place, you know, where women are much more likely to speak up and have a voice than they were 100 years ago or even 50 years ago. But inevitably, it does mean that we are disagreeing more. Because everybody's expected to speak their mind. And when you do that, you find out how much people actually disagree with you. All those people you kind of assumed agreed with you, turns out they do not. And the number of things on which we all agree, in inverted commas, is shrinking very fast. But as I said earlier, we haven't compensated for that by thinking, okay, well, we need to get really good at disagreement. We don't even think about it like that. We don't think of it as a skill that we need to improve at.
Mm-hmm.
So we're just kind of crashing into this new world, not really prepared for it. And I think it's just kind of freaking us all out a bit.
Yeah. And Ian, you actually started, just to change the subject a bit, in advertising. How you ended up becoming a writer, your journey?
My first career was in advertising, and advertising is tremendously interesting and fun. It's actually a great thing to do in your 20s and your 30s. But I kind of got to, and I worked, you know, it gets you around the world. I worked in New York and London, and flew around and also, you know, it's a really kind of great thing, great career, I think. But fundamentally, I didn't find it that satisfying. And at some point in my kind of mid to late 30s, I started thinking, well, what else is there? I'm not sure I want to be doing this interesting but fundamentally quite silly job, you know, for the rest of my life. I do really enjoy writing, and I love thinking about ideas. So maybe I can do that. So I went part time. I resigned from my job and started to freelance so that I could do, you know, spend fewer hours in advertising, and just gave myself more time and space to write. Really inspired by that whole kind of genre of smart thinking or smart ideas books that opened up in the wake of Malcolm Gladwell's first books. I sort of started writing in that space and doing some journalism as well. Here we are, a few books later. And this is kind of, actually, I still do work in advertising and communications. I'm still a strategist. At the heart of what I do is writing.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah. So this is a podcast about long-form journalism, and I was wondering about conflict in journalism. Some of it talked about and experienced, meaning Twitter. But I think, but what do you think in general about how we conduct ourselves in journalism these days? How could we navigate, or how can we navigate conflict better as journalists?
Well, there's a kind of debate going on in journalism at the moment, which is, should we be more openly kind of committed to social justice or things that we believe in, and should we drop this kind of facade of neutrality where we are pretend to be even-handed about issues where there's only really one legitimate side of the argument? Right, you're familiar, yeah, familiar with this kind of debate,
very
right?
Much so. Yeah. Very much so.
And my view is very much that we need to retain objectivity of a kind. I'm not sure objectivity is the right word, actually, but I think it's more to do with curiosity. Actually, you know, going back to the theme of my last book, which is connected to this one, you know, which is, you might think that that other person has this view, which you think is completely illegitimate, or this group of people you're kind of ruling out of the sphere of legitimate debate. But as a journalist, your job is to understand them. And your job is to be interested in how they come to how they came to think like that, and to be interested and to be genuinely curious about someone does actually involve dropping a little bit of your judgmentalism, and you know, it's interesting because it does relate to some of the people I talked to for this book. As I say, are people who work in interrogation and hostage negotiation. And to do their job properly, they have to drop their judgmentalism, right? Expert, really good interrogators, there's lots of bad interrogators, but the really good ones, the really effective ones, do not walk into the room and say, right, you terrible person, you need to tell me exactly what you know, or we're going to throw the book at you, or whatever we're going to do. Because they know that doesn't work. It just effectively kind of ends the conversation, or, you know, closes off any possibility of conversation, because the other person just sort of closes down and digs in. What they do is they walk into the room and they say something like, look, you don't have to talk. If you don't want to, it's your legal right not to talk. You can leave the room now, right, if you want to. But I just really would like to hear your story, because I'm just interested in how you ended up here. Well, you know, what happened? And, you know, these hardened terrorists who have been trained in camps for years to exactly for this kind of situation just sort of break down and gush and tell them their story, and with it a lot of valuable information, all the things they weren't supposed to say. It's people really want to be heard, and they want to tell their story, and of course the interrogator then gets what he or she wants. But the point about it is that the interrogator has to do this genuinely, right? If they walk in there thinking, I'm going to trick this person into telling me their story, the suspect can tell, right? These are, you know, often quite smart people, certainly socially intelligent people. They can tell when you're trying to trick them. So you have to walk in there and you have to be genuinely curious. So why is this terrible person who, may, by the way, may have just tried to kill or may have killed or injured colleagues of mine? You have to put your judgment aside and say, well, I'm just going to be interested in this person. Now, I think if interrogators of terrorists can do that, then journalists from the New York Times or whatever can surely put their judgmentalism aside and talk to people who they think are, you know, racist or misogynist or whatever, and get interested in them as human beings. Because you're going to understand them a lot better, and you're also going to get a lot better information. So I think there's a principle, which is you're not activists, you're journalists, right? Your job is to uncover reality. It's not to shape reality to whatever ends. Because, by the way, you might be wrong. You know, that for me, the humility is just a key part of this. You might not be seeing the world, and, you know, perfectly correctly. Maybe you can learn even from your enemies. And also, you know, you're just going to get a much richer picture of reality if you are able to get information even from people that you dislike or instinctively dismiss. So yeah, that's my kind of view of that debate.
Based on your observation, when people seek a conflict, do they do it typically because for the sake of it, or because they feel passionately about it? Let's say online, what is a bigger motivator Do we have people that really like to argue, or just people that feel very passionately about things?
Maybe we can just put online aside for a minute, because I think this mm-hmm. general principles extend on or offline. Often what you find when somebody is being very kind of aggressive or hostile, it is there's some they feel slighted or insecure. They feel like they have to be on the defensive, and often that means going on the offensive. Sometimes people are just horrible because they think that's the way. On social media, you know, there's a big incentive to just win attention and retweets and likes. And one of the ways you can do that is by being vile to people, right? So there's a big kind mm-hmm. of incentive problem with social media in particular. But let's put that to one side. I think there's a good question is, you know, why when I'm in a disagreement and the other person is being, I think, quite unpleasant or maybe kind of a little bit crazy or irrational, you know, what's going on here? And often what's going on here, not always, but often, that person actually feels like they are not getting the respect or esteem or even affection that they need and deserve. Right? So this could be as mm-hmm. true of a disagreement you're having with your mother, you know, or your sister, as it is of somebody when you're disagreeing with your boss at work, or a political debate or anything, right? Why is this person being really kind of difficult to handle? Well, it's often because they think that you are trying to dominate them in some way, even politely, even subtly, and they push back. So a big kind of reason that disagreements go wrong is that somebody is kind of pushing a little bit too hard on a door. Let's go back to what I was talking about, interrogators. You know, interrogators, mm-hmm. they don't even say, you know, the good ones do not even say politely, please, you need to tell me what you need. You need to tell me what you know. This is going to go a lot better if you just tell me this information. They very rarely say even do that, because when you push like that, what happens is you get pressure coming back the other way, right? Psychologists call it reactance, or sometimes call it the backfire effect, right? You try and persuade someone to agree with you or to come around to your point of view or to do something. It's kind of natural, perverse human tendency to say, hey, back off. And that can manifest itself as hostility and aggression or just sullenness and so on. So your job is not to kind of push them into the position that you want them. It's to find a way of lowering their defenses, lowering the pressure on them so that they actually feel good about being a little bit more free and thoughtful and flexible in their position. And often that means, you know, that can mean showing them that you respect them. Like sometimes, you know, just explicitly saying, look, I think I really respect what you've done and your position here, or I really agree with you on this, but I have a question about this. You know, you're looking mm-hmm. for ways to make them just feel a little bit more secure in the exchange, so that they can be a little bit more flexible in the disagreement.
Okay, but what if you deal with an actual bully, with someone pretty aggressive who is trying to dominate you and not in a polite way, okay? So, meaning, do we always, you know, your article talks about giving people the face, correct? I'm sorry, I probably...
Yeah, no, that's basically what I was talking about. So, you know, everybody has a face that they want to project in a conversation, especially if there are lots of people in the room, or if in, you know, online, there can be many people in the room. And the skillful kind of disagreeer actually gives some thought to how can I make the other person look good? How can I do the face work on their behalf, right? This is, you know, a bit like what AOC was talking about. How can I allow them to be more flexible in their position and maybe agree with me a little bit more whilst looking good in front of the people that they want to look good in front of, right? That's a real, there's a real art to that.
Yeah.
Now, your prior question was, you know, what if they're just horrible? Yeah, I mean, some people are. You walk away. I mean, I'm not saying that everybody can be dealt with like this. No, everybody can be engaged with. Sometimes you're just dealing with terrible people or people who are just in a terrible mood and just are not going to engage with you. But what I would say is that often the people who, you know, don't make that judgment too quickly is what I would say, right? Often the people who you think are going to be really aggressive or unpleasant or dishonest in engaging with you can be managed in a way that actually brings out the best in them. And you can, if you're skillful, you can make that relationship work and therefore make the disagreement productive. So yes, absolutely. Sometimes what you're learning is that this person cannot be engaged with, but actually you shouldn't make up your mind about that too quickly. You should see what you can do to make the relationship work before you get into the disagreement.
Yeah. In your article, you also mentioned how important it is to arrest people, right? I mean, being a policeman, you know, and could you talk a bit about that and how important it is to not humiliate people? And you even said something very striking that this is how the revenge is being born, and you know, this is how your colleagues can get killed when you're arresting someone and you humiliate this person.
I spent time with police in the US with the Memphis Police Department, who are being trained in de-escalation skills mm-hmm. by a group of very thoughtful, very intelligent ex-cops who, by the way, are as horrified or more horrified perhaps than anyone by some of the abuses that we see in the news in terms of the police, the US police at the moment. And the more kind of forward-thinking and innovative police departments are doing these kind of de-escalation and communication training to make sure that these situations don't get into the position where abuse or violence becomes more of a possibility. And one of the things that these guys emphasize is, you know, in an arrest situation, you're arresting someone in the street, you need to do it in a way that respects the other person's dignity, right? It's the right thing to do, first of all, you know, it's just the right thing to do. But also just tactically, if you like, things are going to go better if you say, okay, you know, let's get the cuffs on because I don't want to get into a fight with you because, you know, you could clearly do me some damage. Yeah, whatever it is, it's like there might be some kind of, you know, there's always some way of showing that, like, that person's dignity, their sense of pride is intact. And what these guys were saying, and the cops in the room were nodding, which is you often see people doing exactly the opposite. Like, there are some cops who will just go out of their way to humiliate that person, right? To make them feel like, you know, like they're very small, to make them feel terrible when they're arresting them, who really kind of enjoy the exercise of dominance. And, you know, not only is that wrong, again, but also it backfires in a big way. And yeah, so one of the cops I quote was saying, you know, humiliation ends up killing your colleagues. Because some of these guys who get humiliated in an arrest, and maybe they go to prison, but then years later they remember it, and they go on a revenge mission, and they kill any cop they see, and it's just because, you know, they were treated so badly. So, you know, the way you treat someone it ends up kind of rebounding on you. Now, most of us aren't in these kind of life or death violent situations. But even in the way we treat people just in our kind of like more day-to-day kind of civilian discourse, we should be just be careful to make, you know, treat people in a way that makes them feel good about themselves, not just because it's the right thing to do, which it is, but also because it's just going to be good for your for your relationship, and it's going to be good for the discourse in general.
Yeah. I was wondering, what is the role of misunderstanding in conflict? Because sometimes it's just that, right? Sometimes we don't get to the depth of the issue and we think that we disagree before we actually disagree. I was wondering if there is a lot of, you know, misconstructed conflict online that maybe doesn't necessarily even exist there. Thoughts?
Yeah, and not just online, but generally, you often get, we often get into disagreements where both or all the parties are not actually clear on what you're disagreeing about.
You know? Like COVID-19?
It happens with COVID-19, but it can happen on a conversation, you know, in a conversation about your family or at work. The kind of the argument takes on a kind of life of its own, and the thing about which you were disagreeing on kind of disappears or never really was defined in the first place. And sometimes you can be arguing about things where each person has a very different idea of what the argument is over. And so, yeah, one of the things I say is try and work out what the disagreement is about and try and agree on that first, right? Mm-hmm. Just getting that basic agreement of, okay, so what is actually our point of conflict here? What is the thing that we're disagreeing about? Let's be clear about that first and then get into the argument over it. We don't do that often enough. Now, sometimes it's a disagreement over a kind of empirical matter, and so that will direct your argument in one way. Like, you know, are we disagreeing about the rate at which people die from COVID-19? Is that what we're disagreeing about? Or the effect of lockdowns, whether or not they're effective, is that what we're disagreeing about? Well, that's an empirical matter, and we can kind of cite evidence in order to come to a point of view on that. Or are we disagreeing about our values, something, you know, to do with our values? All right, are we saying that actually I value the, you know, I think we should pay less attention to the deaths of old people and value more highly the education of our children. I think the latter is actually is more important than the former, you know, going forward. Okay, fine. That's an argument you can have because at least you kind of defined what it's about. It's a difficult one because, you know, arguments over values are tough. But at least you kind of, and you've separated it from the empirical question. So, yeah, so it's certainly misunderstanding and, yeah, mutual kind of talking past each other is a big reason that disagreements go wrong.
Yeah. So a good productive conflict can potentially lead to a change of mind on one side or both. And do you remember those spectacular change of minds that, of course, happen to everybody towards life? Do you remember when you changed your mind spectacularly? I'm laughing because I realize that this is a very unfair question and I'm not sure how I would answer myself.
Yeah, it's funny. I'm not sure that's the right way to think about it. We do often think about it like that. Like we think of a change of mind as this kind of 180 degree turn where you think, well, I was for capital punishment. And then I had this conversation and afterwards I was like, wow, I'm totally against it. That person really changed my mind. And when we're in an argument, that's sometimes what we think is going to happen. I'm going to make this brilliant argument, and the other person is going to go, oh my gosh, you're totally right, and I'm completely wrong. Thank you. I mean, this is a fantasy. It's pure fantasy. That's not how it works. Now, neither is it true that nobody ever changes their mind about anything. But people change their mind kind of gradually and over time, right? Most of the time.
Yeah.
And so when you're in an argument over something, I don't think you should have the expectation that I'm going to blow this person's mind. They're going to completely agree with me by the end of it. That's not going to happen. The best you can do is offer an alternative perspective on something and hope that either in the conversation that you're having, or perhaps 3 weeks later when they're reflecting on it, that you modify their view on it, that you've actually kind of changed their mind in the sense of just changed it a little, right? Not completely, radically changed their position, but maybe they've changed, maybe they've got a bit more information, a bit more insight into how other people, or people on the other side of the debate think. And I think that's probably, that's true, in terms of that's how people change their mind. But also it's going to make the conversation go better because you're not going to press so hard on your point. Because you want people to walk away from the conversation thinking, okay, that guy was not a total asshole, right? Because if you are, then they're not going to give what you said any thought. There's a great quote actually from one of the cops who said, the moment that that he's talking about, suspects or just be criminals or people you're trying to arrest. He says, the moment that they sense that you dislike them is the moment that they feel they can ignore you. And so he said, when I'm trying to persuade somebody, because I don't want to arrest them. I'm just trying to persuade them to stop doing the thing that they're doing. And I'm trying to calm the conversation down. If I do it in a way that signals that I dislike them, they're going to stop listening to me. And in fact, they might get aggressive. Signaling to your interlocutor that you like and respect them is going to make the conversation go better. And it's going to help them change their mind, if only a little bit.
Yeah. I just wonder how that would work with Hitler, in elevator, this hypothetical situation.
Well, it wouldn't work. But again, I keep saying this, but I'm not saying that everybody have their mind. Not everybody can be engaged in a productive disagreement. That's not my point at all.
No, I do. I just, there's so much work and there's so much patience we have to give to each other. And I was wondering, time. It's a good thing in conflict, right? Conflict gets better over time if we will invest in it. But at the same time, I'm not talking about the conflict that is just being left on its own and just changes into not talking to one another, right?
Yeah. What was your? I didn't understand the question.
Yeah, I'm sorry. There was no question really. I was wondering if time is a good thing with conflict. Should we give ourselves time when we are in a conflict situation, or not necessarily?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly think
the value of time. Yeah, sorry.
I certainly think that slowing down is often a good way to make the conversation go better. If it's going badly, it can be because everybody's speaking too fast and thinking too fast and kind of speaking and thinking very impulsively. This happens on social media because it's just so easy to kind of tap away. But it happens in real life. We have these very kind of fast, speedy, emotional arguments, and just taking a beat, taking a pause, just kind of slowing the pace of it down can help. So yes, I do think that's a good option to try.
I would like to ask you about something that you said, or rather wrote, in 2014. You said, if you do not love Joe Biden, you do not love humanity. And I was wondering, how do you feel about this sentence from a perspective of, well, quite a few years?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I wouldn't put it quite like that right now, but no, I do think that he is somebody who essentially has a kind of a good... He's a large-souled person. He's essentially just a good guy, you know. Now, it doesn't mean that I think he's going to get everything right or that he's doing everything right politically. But I think if you've ever seen him talking to, for instance, families who have been bereaved, you know, there's a video of him talking to families of military, people in the military have lost their lives in service, and you just see this incredible sense of empathy and connection that comes from, you know, obviously the tragedies of his own life, which haven't made him bitter, haven't kind of shriveled him, but have done the opposite. They kind of made him the greater souled and more empathetic person. Yeah, and I guess I would stand by that. I'd say, you know, unless you, I actually don't think that you could watch that or watch him in other contexts and think, you know, here is a terrible guy. You could think he's a bad politician. He makes bad decisions, but being able to separate those two things, I think, is quite important.
Yeah. You also said after Thomas Mann that a writer is someone for whom writing is more difficult than it is for other people, which I found very, very beautiful. Could you tell us why you decided on this particular quote, and what is writing to you?
It's really hard, and it's the kind of thing that is easy in one sense, and that anybody, well, if you're literate, anybody can write sentences, and they'll make some kind of vague sense, and so therefore people think it's, you know, it's quite easy to kind of write an article or write a book, but then when you try it, it turns out it's incredibly hard, and it's not just hard to write well; it's hard to write not badly. So Thomas Mann's point was, you know, writers are somebody who their job is to think about writing well, and that so their job is to make the act of writing difficult. So it's a bit of a cry from the heart.
Yeah. So your book, Conflicted, is very, very new, but I'm sure you're already thinking about next projects, or maybe not. Maybe you're taking a vacation. What's in your mind? What do you think you will be doing next?
I honestly don't know. I would like to write another book, but I'm considering all sorts of different themes at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you so much for this. This is Cover Story, and we spoke today with Ian Leslie. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Really enjoyed it.